It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Evers ordered a special session in the Wisconsin legislature to take up two bills on gun control. Yesterday, state Republicans gaveled in and gaveled out, ending the session within just a few moments. We'll learn more about what happened and the future of gun control measures here in the state. First, African-American cuisine is often thought of as soul food or Southern cooking, but our next guest says there's a huge diversity of styles we don't talk about enough. She's surveyed hundreds of cookbooks from black cooks written over nearly 200 years. She's rounded up some of the classic recipes that evolved over time. And in her newest book, she updates many of those recipes for the modern kitchen and shares the stories behind them. Toni Tipton Martin is an award-winning food journalist. Her latest book is called Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African-American Cooking. Toni, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, again, people sometimes think African-American cooking equals soul food, and you write that's a part of the story, but not by any means the whole story. Can you talk about the diversity of African-American cuisine in American history?
Sure. I always want to pay respects to the creators and the precursors to soul food. That is the food of survival, the food that my ancestors created when the supplies were really meager and they really didn't have a lot of options other than whatever they could find in their natural habitat and whatever was left over. But there is a part of our ancestry that is very rarely talked about, and that would be the people who were doing the cooking in professional settings. And that can be traced, those people can be traced all the way back to the plantation kitchen house where they were cooking. A plantation cook was cooking elaborate meals, sometimes requiring French culinary training. And that food, in my view, and in the view of the authors who passed that down through generations, belongs to those folks. And we just have not given them credit where credit was due.
And your new book, Jubilee, it's a follow-up to an earlier project you'd done where you found so many of these cookbooks going back as far as the early 1800s. What was it like going back and seeing these recipes, sometimes in the words of the cook who cooked them, or maybe at one remove, and starting to connect people and names to these recipes?
It was really thrilling for me as a journalist. I was a reporter in pursuit of a story, to tell you the truth. I was looking for my grandmother on the pages of Southern food history, and everywhere I looked, there were all of these disparaging images of black women, not often portrayed as intellectual and certainly not as people who had apprenticed on the job or learned while doing. And so I had this brilliant idea, I thought, that I would just look up a few cookbooks and be able to hear the words and voices of these people. And before I knew it, the University of Alabama published a bibliography with some 400 titles on it. And I started Googling them and entering them into my browser. And now I am also the owner of more than 400 of these books.
And you write in Jubilee that if we could take some of these African-American cooks, whether they were in the plantation, as you mentioned, or maybe a free black cook in the north somewhere, a lot of the people you're writing about, if we transplanted them to 2019, they would probably be celebrity chefs today.
They absolutely would be. And if we think about how we honor our celebrity chefs today, it is people who we respect for the food that they prepared at work, right? We do not know what any of our favorites do at home with their families, unless that's their chosen book title, right, or their show. But mostly we respect and revere them for what they prepare at work. And African Americans have not been afforded the same equity in the industry. We always make the turn and revert back to the survival kitchen and the struggle. And as I said at the outset, I have the utmost respect for that canon, but I want to ensure that we're able to consider that people who have been preparing food with bechamel sauce all day and working with fine ingredients, if they had leftovers in that kitchen and took them home, for example, a trained chef who might have been working with asparagus and making a hollandaise sauce, we can assume that if he had some lemon juice and butter when he got home, he would prepare it in the same manner. And that's what I'm hoping for, is that we give respect to the people that were hotel owners and oyster house owners and vendors who were selling pralines in New Orleans. There's just the list of incredible people who were talented and knowledgeable in many ways, not just in cooking, but also these are people who would have had business skills, who understood quality of ingredients and all kinds of things that we think about that are taught in Culinary Academy today.
Talking to Toni Tipton Martin. Her new book is called Jubilee Recipes from Two Centuries of African American Cooking. Before we start to turn toward the recipes, Toni, can you talk about the concept of Jubilee? It's got a religious component to it. There's also the idea of a celebration of freedom. Why Jubilee in terms of the recipes you're sharing here?
Well, don't you just love that title? I do. I think it's just so cool to be able to use this work as an expression of our freedom from stereotype, all of us. But we're no longer encumbered by expectations. We can come now to this book and to this material and to African Americans and ultimately to one another with hopefully not limiting our relationships to preconceived notions, right? And my hope is that people who will come to find a new respect and surprise about African American food history will be able to then open their minds and think, I wonder what else it is that I don't know about another person from another culture, and hopefully we can bring down some of the barriers that have been erected between us artificially, in my opinion, and increase our power for one another.
We're talking to Toni Tipton Martin, award-winning food journalist. She's with us to talk about her new cookbook, Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African-American Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Toni about the cooking styles she's talking about, writing about, the stories behind them, and the history behind these dishes? Is this part of your story, part of your culinary heritage, African-American cooking styles from anywhere around the country? And whatever your background, have you done this kind of history, gone back to your old family recipes, gotten the stories behind them, and maybe recreated them in your own kitchen? How'd that turn out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. By the way, we've got a few recipes from Toni's book. You can find those at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Toni Tipton Martin. She's a food journalist and cookbook author. Her latest book is called Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African-American Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the research she's done into the history of African-American cooking? Or do you have a story of your own, if this is part of your own food heritage? And have you done something like what she did, gone back and found historical recipes from whatever culture here in the United States and try to recreate them in your own kitchen? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Toni, one thing I love that you bring up in your book is fusion cuisine has been kind of a hip, cool thing in recent years. And you write that African-American cooking has always been a fusion of different kind of cultural backgrounds and heritages. Can you talk about that?
That is absolutely true. And then when we think about it, American cooking is a fusion style as well. Both began with the idea of European recipes that were blended with African hands and Native American ingredients. And all of that fused together to give us what we know today as American food, Southern food, and ultimately, of course, of African American food. And so African Americans, as they were migrating around the country, took those elements with them out of the South, and they were integrated in various communities depending upon what they might find there. And so that could be different ingredients in the natural environment, like if they were accustomed to making nut breads in the South with pecans, then if they moved into a region where there were blueberries, they would add blueberries to the mix and you would get blueberry bread, banana bread. These are dishes that persisted all throughout the African American canon of recipes that I discovered in the cookbooks that date back to 1827.
I want to share one of the recipes that you shared with us. We've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's a wilted mixed greens with bacon. I'm looking at this beautiful picture of it with, I think, the bacon being drizzled over the top of it. And I look at it, I think the word salad, and you said this one didn't actually show up listed as a salad in a lot of the older cookbooks you looked at.
No, that's right. One of my favorite dishes growing up was spinach salad with bacon and hard-boiled eggs and mushrooms. I just loved that. And so it was quite a surprise to me to discover in the Southern food canon and the soul food experience that there was a dish called wilted or killed lettuce. And that we share that dish with folks in Appalachia who also call it killed lettuce. And it was this idea that there were bitter greens in the natural environment, like we think about dandelions, we think about various wild things, purslane and chicory and other bitter greens. And the concept of the practice of sautéing bacon and mixing vinegar with the oil to make a dressing, a warm dressing that you pour over those greens, just sort of takes the edge off of the warm salad. And today we do that all of the time, right? We have bacon spinach salad is one of the top salads you can get. You can even buy it in commercial, kitchen restaurants and in bulk at Costco. And so it's a favorite. It's a favorite. And it was fun to me to discover that it had this long standing history.
And in your version of this recipe, we've got not some of those bitter greens you're talking about, but you're looking for tender greens in this one. The spinach, like you mentioned, growing up with, or arugula, chard, baby kale, watercress. These are, you might find those at any fancy restaurant there. This sounds really good.
They're also available at the farmer's market, right? And so we often go through the market and we think, oh, I just don't know what else to do, but I see all these lovely greens and everything looks so fresh and vibrant. And here's a dish that has got a longstanding history and it's adaptable. My family's taste buds tended more towards salad, so we don't make the dressing really heavy or hot. And we like the taste of the greens to really punch and come through. But the longer that the dressing soaks and the more the greens soak up that dressing, then they become limp and their taste profile tones down quite a bit. I also sprinkle mine with blue cheese. We really like ours that way. So I'm encouraging readers to really participate in the expression of these dishes in the way that my ancestors would have. They would have adapted dishes according to their environment and what resources permitted for them to do that with. And I want others to do that today.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Keith is with us in Kenosha. Keith, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, this is kind of maybe a sociological question, but we've all heard about something called food deserts, and they say, boy, we can't get fresh foods to these places. But I've often kind of wondered if in some of these areas over time, people have lost their traditions of how to cook these kind of foods. And therefore, even if you got the fresh foods there, really don't know what to do with them.
Keith, thanks for the call. And we hear sometimes, people in cities lose that connection with the land and where the food comes from. Is that something you worry about, Tony, that these recipes you trace the history of might get lost in translation sometimes?
Well, absolutely. The idea that we have food deserts and that families have been detached from the practice of home cooking and self-care is definitely a problem, and it's evident in our healthcare system where we can see African Americans suffering disproportionately from diseases that have diet as a risk factor. So we certainly do want to encourage people to consume more vegetables and less meat and sweets and sugar and salt and all of those, things that can be overindulged in. And so one of the ways that I am hoping to address that is by helping families see that there is a dignified history for them in food preparation. Our history has been portrayed as one of heavily laborious, and slaving in the kitchen is the term most often associated with cooking. And we want to really turn that around. And as a result of that, the photographs in Jubilee are spectacularly beautiful. That was, you know, done intentionally. Jarrell Guy, the photographer, had an incredible eye for the art of cooking, and just the selection of the serveware and things like that were intentional. We want to restore pride in cooking and help people understand that their ancestors were not natural-born geniuses, but they weren't hard, ignorant laborers either. They were people that were trained on the job. They were people that passed traditions to one another. And if we want to live healthier, more productive lives, we have to pass those traditions on again. And I'm hoping that we do that with the simple but beautiful dishes in Jubilee.
Keith, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Wanda with us in Orfordville. Wanda, hi.
Hi. The question for Toni: in her great collection of recipe books going back two centuries, maybe, did they list quantities as we insist upon today, teaspoons and tablespoons and cups, or was it so much of this and a good handful of that?
Wanda, thanks for the call. I've seen that in older recipes, Toni, where it's kind of ballpark measurements. What kind of things did you see?
Well, these were people who were very conscientious about the delivery of their recipes, and they often spoke in their introductions about the recipes developing over years of experience. They made sure to make that point. But at the same time, they did often, the recipes fluctuated. Sometimes there would be very precise measurements where irrelevant, and other places there would be measurements that were equivalents in the natural environment. And that was really, that took place a lot in the early 19th century when people weren't thinking in terms of measuring spoons. We get stuck thinking about that as normal today, but that's an occurrence that began around the late 19th century when domestic science and home economics were taking a hold of our women, and we started to quantify dishes. But home cooks always worked with visuals and talked about measurements in terms of things that were familiar, like the size of a walnut or the size of an egg. And so they were still very precise. If they said a teacup, that there was a standardness about that measurement. But those measurements don't necessarily translate to the measures that we use today.
Toni, we're talking to Toni Tipton-Martin about her new book, Jubilee Recipes from Two Centuries of African-American Cooking. Thanks for that call. That reminds me of another recipe you shared with us, baked barbecued beans. One ingredient in the original recipe from Ernestine Williams for her famous barbecue baked beans, one of the ingredients was Ernestine's barbecue sauce. So this was a challenge. You couldn't buy a jar of that, so you had to recreate this yourself.
How about that? And I, what I did was I just cross-referenced every recipe that I had that I, you know, was working with. I chose a selection of cookbooks from the collection. I obviously could not refer to every one of the 400 every time. So I did make a choice and had a dozen or so that were my standard bearers for how to anchor myself in history. And I just cross-referenced and was able to determine that there was a particular style or type of ingredients that seemed to reoccur over and over over time. And that's how I was able to arrive at this idea for these beans. These beans were really important to me because I grew up loving pork and beans and beans and franks. And if we think of that as a food of poverty, but there was a time when home cooked beans were a something special. You had them at barbecues, they were at family reunions. And so they became a sort of a memory dish. And so I wanted to include them for that reason.
One more recipe you shared with us, and I love this, and it's in part inspired by an 1866 recipe you create here, Caribbean roast pork. And this is complete with rum and lime juice and ginger and allspice and sugar. Can you talk about the Caribbean part of the story?
Sure. So the original concept for this book and its idea that there are two strains of African American cooking is not an original idea to me. I discovered that in the readings of an historian, Arturo Schoenberg, who in the 30s wrote a proposal for a cookbook with some 600 dishes in it. And among those dishes was a dish that he called West Indies pork. And I racked my brain looking through all of the cookbooks trying to find an equivalent. What was this man talking about? And I searched and found different adaptations. And, of course, the Cooks of the Caribbean had dishes that were meat proteins that were jerked or other highly spiced meat that were cooked on the grill. But what was really fun was to discover that the singer Khalees included in her cookbook that you left several years, a dish for a combination dish that was a Caribbean pork, and she had some Caribbean jerked ribs. And so I took some liberties with her version and another version, and arrived at this really wonderful dish that you insert. You make slices, into the pork roast and insert little slips of garlic so that amazing aroma and taste penetrates the meat, and so every bite is garlicky and spicy and tender. It's great.
Well, that's some great inspiration for weekend cooking. Tony, thank you so much for sharing the recipes and the stories with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And you know, you have one of these experts right there in your backyard, Carson Gulley, at the Carson Gulley Center. So I encourage your listeners to learn more about one of the home guys there.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Toni Tipton-Martin, award-winning food journalist. She joined us today to share her latest book. It's called Jubilee, Recipes from 2 Centuries of African-American Cooking. You can take them for a spin this weekend. Head over to WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got that Caribbean roast pork we were just talking about, the baked barbecue beans, and the wilted mixed greens with bacon. That's a whole meal right there. Let me know when to stop by. I'd love to try them. Actually, and there's another one. We don't have this up. It's a bread pudding with a whiskey sauce. I like bread pudding, and I like the taste of whiskey, so I might give that one a shot this weekend as well. That's this week's edition of Food Friday. Now, coming up after the news, state Republicans bypassed Governor Evers' order to hold a special session on gun control. We'll learn more about what happened. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, nearly 2,000 Americans who fought in the Vietnam War are still officially unaccounted for. We'll learn about the government's decades-long program to identify remains and return them home to family members. First, state Republicans bypassed an order from Democratic Governor Tony Evers to hold a special session to vote on 2 bills that would change how the state handles background checks and other gun issues in Wisconsin. Republicans yesterday gaveled in and gaveled out of the proceedings in the span of a few seconds. Top state GOP leaders have argued they don't want to infringe on the constitutional rights of residents. Governor Evers and fellow Democrats were critical of the move. Patrick Marley is state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Patrick, what did Governor Evers want the legislature to vote on? What 2 bills in this special session?
The 2 bills are, one would have universal background checks, so virtually all firearm purchases would have to go through a background check. There'd be an exemption for family members transferring guns from one to the other, but things like gun shows or sales that are arranged online that don't have to go through background checks under federal law would have to go under a check under his legislation. And then the other one would establish what's popularly known as red flag law, essentially allow a family member or police to go to a judge to say that they believe someone is dangerous, and then that person could have their gun temporarily taken away while the judge and the courts determined whether it could be kept from them for a longer period.
And talk about the use of the special session in Wisconsin. What can governors do with special sessions?
So governors have the power to bring legislators in on any issue that they designate, and the lawmakers have no choice but to come in. But that's where their authority ends. Once they have come to Madison and gathered, they don't have to actually do anything. And we saw that yesterday. The Republicans, who had said for quite some time this is what they would do, bang their gavel, ordered the beginning of the special session, and then immediately banged it again to end it.
Yeah, take us through the timeline. People, reporters like you, were watching all day to see when these sessions would start. Break down. It'll take about as long to break down as it did in real time.
Right. So the governor had called the special session to start at 2 p.m. They don't have to come in at that exact time, but they do have to come in on that day, and they can't come in before 2 p.m. So we knew that sometime between 2 p.m. and midnight they would do this. The Senate wasn't in session, in its regular session, on Thursday, and so they were able to, they didn't have to have all their members there. In fact, all they needed to have was one to do this. That was the majority leader, Scott Fitzgerald. And so we were told that we would be given some kind of heads up before they came in, but not a lot of heads up. And he arrived in the Capitol about 8 p.m. as advertised, walked up to the front of the chamber, read from a script, banged his gavel, said a few words, ended the session, banged his gavel again, and then came over and talked to reporters. He was the only senator who was in the room. Earlier, Democrats sort of tried to highlight the lack of action on this bill by holding a prayer session. Many of the Democratic senators were there at 2 p.m., talked up the issue. Obviously, they couldn't actually hold a session because they didn't have a quorum. And highlighted the issue. Over in the Assembly, they were in for their usual session, and so they were meeting on other bills throughout the day, and then in the evening, just as they were concluding their regular session, they banged the gavel, and within about 10 seconds, banged it back out again.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a very short special session on two pieces of gun legislation in Wisconsin's state legislature. Patrick, what did Republicans have to say about why they didn't bring up any debate or votes on these two pieces of legislation?
They say they're united against these things, that they thought the governor should have offered some other plan, that he knew all along that they weren't supportive of these. For the red flag law, Republicans say they don't think there's enough due process protections in place. Some other states do have these laws, but they say this is based on what someone thinks you might do. Robin Voss, the speaker, gives the example of saying this would be like having someone seize your car because they think you might drive drunk in the future, and that it's not enough to take someone's gun away because you think they possibly could do something. On the universal background checks, the explanation that Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader, has given is that he says gun owners fear that this would lead to a registry where the government would track who owns which guns. That's not in this legislation. This legislation would just essentially expand the existing background checks that are made on most gun purchases, like when you buy them at a gun store, to private sales. So when two individuals sell a gun, or when a sale is arranged online and they meet in person and sell the gun, you'd have the same checks done there. It doesn't create a registry, but Fitzgerald says he fears that it would put us on a path to eventually getting one.
And what did Democrats have to say in reaction to the Republicans' in-and-out approach to the special session?
Well, there has been a lot of polling on this nationally and in Wisconsin, and both ideas are very popular. The Marquette poll has shown that 80% of people support universal background checks, and a similar number support red flag laws. So that is really what the Democrats highlight, that this is what the people want. You should be doing their business. They note that even gun owners, even if you poll just gun owners, a majority of them support universal background checks and a red flag law. So they say they're ignoring the will of the people is the heart of their argument.
Is anything else going on in the legislature related to gun violence or gun-related suicide?
Well, the Assembly did spend much of its day yesterday trying to address suicide. They had a task force that Robin Voss had put together on suicide prevention. And so they passed a number of bills yesterday that would put more money toward suicide prevention services, and some of them are sort of related in that they would provide financial education to farmers about their finances so that they can get through tough times more easily, saying that that cash flow problems, money problems are a big cause of suicide in rural areas because of the farm crisis.
And Patrick, given the current governor and the current makeup of the legislature, is there any thought that these two pieces of legislation, expanding background checks and red flag laws, are going to come up anytime soon again?
Well, certainly Democrats are going to be talking about it through Election Day. There's no doubt about that. The governor has raised the prospect of calling more special sessions on this. I think that there's, you know, really no sign that things would go any differently were he to do that again. But, you know, the governor got a lot of attention on an issue that he feels is important yesterday. So I think it's something we'll hear a lot about for the next year or more, but not necessarily something that you'll see a lot done on.
What are you watching for next, Patrick? Nothing going to happen on this between now and the next elections?
Apart from talking about it. Right. The Assembly is in on Tuesday, and the Senate is done for the rest of the year. So no one's going to be back after Tuesday. They won't be back until January. You know, I think that this week in the legislature highlights how far apart the governor and the Republicans who control the legislature are, and that we're really at a place of gridlock that you know, it doesn't look like anything much of major significance is going to get done. They were able to get a state budget written this summer, and it looks like that will be the sort of the beginning and the end of big legislation that happens in this session.
Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to us about a special session, a brief session on gun control in the state capitol yesterday. Coming up, we'll learn about the government's efforts to identify missing soldiers from the Vietnam War and return their remains to families. That's coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the La Crosse Police Department is requiring political campaigns to cover some of their costs before holding rallies in the city. We'll find out more in our Wisconsin News Roundup. Now, over 58,000 Americans died in the Vietnam War, and nearly 2,000 soldiers are still officially unaccounted for. For decades, the U.S. government has been working to identify the missing and return their remains to their family members. Advances in science and the persistence of military families have helped make the program more successful. Our next guest has observed just about every part of the process of bringing a soldier home, and her search took her to Bayfield, Wisconsin. Sarah Wagner is an associate professor of anthropology at George Washington University and the author of What Remains, Bringing America's Missing Home from the Vietnam War. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm very happy to be able to speak with you.
Well, in researching the stories you tell here, you spent a lot of time in Wisconsin in the Bayfield area, following the story in particular of Marine Lance Corporal Merlin Ray Allen. Can you talk about what led you to Wisconsin and his story?
Yeah. Well, it started back in 2012 as part of the research I was doing for this book, which is looking into the U.S. military's efforts to account for its missing in action from the Vietnam War. I had the honor and the privilege to be able to accompany a recovery team, so a U.S. military recovery team that was investigating, trying to find and dig a site of a helicopter crash. And so I took part in that recovery mission, and it was stretched about 28 days in total. We were base camping, so we were literally living in the jungle, and every day we would hike up about 20 minutes to the crash site, which was located on a fairly steep slope on the mountainside. And our task was to try and find five guys, the remains of five individuals who, you know, had been killed in that helicopter crash. And it took us until day 9 before we actually found remains. And over the course of that month, we ended up recovering a total of 7 teeth and a few tiny bits of bone. And out of those 7 teeth, one was definitively correlated with Lance Corporal Merlin Ray Allen. And so, you know, I sort of followed from afar as the case wound its way through the laboratory, the identification process. And in 2013, his family was notified, and a survivor of the helicopter crash, who has essentially become a part of that family, flew out to Hawaii to the laboratory where the remains had been tested and analyzed. And he was, this is a man named Jeff Sabacool, and he was able to escort the remains and essentially bring his best friend, Merle Allen, back to the Allen family. And that's, in, you know, following that case from being there as a part of the recovery team to later being able to talk with the family members, get to know some of the siblings, to work with the local community. There's a VFW post in a little town north of Bayfield called Red Cliff. And so in tracing out this story, it just, you know, every time I went back to the community, I realized that there was not just Merlin Ray Allen's story to tell, but also that of another killed in action but body not recovered. That's Dwayne Soulier. And the Red Cliff VFW post is actually named after Dwayne. And so working with the Allen family and with some of the members of that VFW post, I began to understand, you know, how was this little town impacted by the Vietnam War? And what did homecoming, you know, fallen hero come back to them mean? What does that mean to those who survived, the family, friends, classmates, so on and so forth? And in the case of Dwayne Soulier, that he has not yet been recovered. And how does his family and how do those veterans at the VFW post continue to honor him? So Wisconsin is just, you know, it's had this special place in this project. And it started, you know, way off in central Vietnam, but it brought me back to this, what I argue is, you know, a very special place, both in Bayfield and Red Cliff, and the community of people who, you know, hold on to this memory and you know, and try and help us recall the individual lives lost from their community in the Vietnam War.
That story illustrates the lengths and efforts we go to in the United States to find remains of lost military service people. And I think we kind of take it for granted that that's just what you do. But we're kind of unique, you write, in the United States. Not every country does this. Yeah.
That's absolutely correct. The United States stands apart from other nations in its efforts to, and I think of it as a tradition, a national tradition that's evolved over time. I mean, one could argue that it began, and others have, that it began back with the Civil War. But it's this tradition whereby we insist upon and we labor and we have developed extraordinary forensic expertise in order to locate, so repatriate remains from those who died on foreign soil, bring them back home, and then to identify those remains individually. So that can enable not sort of this collective remembrance of nameless fallen, but rather these individual stories, these individual fallen who return to their families, and these local communities get to reclaim those lives and to care for those remains. And in many ways, you know, the stories of that life, both during their military service and before, they kind of proliferate in that moment.
Talking to Sarah Wagner about her new book, What Remains? Bringing America's Missing Home from the Vietnam War. And in the popular consciousness, or at least I'll say in my consciousness, Vietnam was unique. We had a large percentage of service people who were lost and not identified there. But when you compare Vietnam in your book to some other wars that American service people have served in, how does Vietnam compare?
Yeah, so the numbers are much smaller. With World War II, we have something like 78,000 individual service members who are unaccounted for. Now, approximately 41,000 are carried as non-recoverable, meaning they may have been lost at sea. So that number we need to adjust just a little bit. Although that said, with you know, the changing expertise, including with underwater archaeology, you know, we may begin to think about new possibilities for recovering those. With the Korean War, it's about 7,800, 900. I may be a little off on that number. But with the Vietnam War, it's 1,587. So you can see the significant difference between those three different conflicts and their missing. So missing in action or killed in action, but body not recovered. I do want to juxtapose that for Vietnam itself, you have 300,000 individuals on the Vietnamese side who are carried as missing and are considered missing in action. So, I mean, one of the things when we look at all of these numbers in total, the message we can take away is war is extraordinarily destructive, and that, you know, nations and families and communities They're affected by these losses, not just, you know, the months and weeks, but the years and decades afterwards.
How have changes in DNA technology changed the story when it comes to trying to recover war dead?
Yeah, that's actually how I began this process, or this particular book and the research behind it. I had been working in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and this is, you know, post-war Bosnia. They had a lot of missing persons, and DNA ended up being kind of the engine driving that entire recovery identification process. And interestingly, there were two geneticists who helped jumpstart that identification effort. And both of them had come from the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory. Both of them had had a hand in helping to identify the Vietnam War unknown soldier who had been buried. His remains had been buried right here in outside of D.C. in Arlington National Cemetery. And that moment when it turned out to be First Lieutenant Michael J. Blassie, when Blassie was identified, Secretary of Defense Cohen, he came forth and he said, William Cohen, he came forth and he said, it may be that we may not have other unknowns in future wars. And I think for me, that moment, it just was this game changer, both in signaling how far advances in forensic science were beginning to drive this process, and also the sort of expectations that we have about what DNA can achieve. And in many cases, it is an extraordinarily powerful tool that the forensic scientists can levy in order to identify, you know, some tiny scraps of bone. On the other hand, there's the flip side is that it does raise expectations. And for families for whom remains have not been recovered, or possibly remains which, you know, even with that most cutting edge tool, it can't unlock and it can't reassociate a name to the set of remains, that there can be a little bit of a jarring sense between our expectations and even, you know, the most powerful of forensic tools and what it's able to achieve.
You tell a story of science and of politics when it comes to bringing back remains of American service members. But more deeply, you're telling a story about ritual. What did you discover about American culture in researching this process?
Well, I mean, on some level, I try and suggest that, you know, the science itself helps to create new forms of meaning making and new forms of ritual. But I also was intrigued by how families, how communities, how, you know, the missing in action, they themselves ended up producing different kinds of rituals. So, for example, we might think of the POW MIA flag, right? Well, that's that, you know, the symbol that most of us, when we see it, we recognize it. And we know that that's a call out to those service members who did not come home. Or we can take the missing man table. This is the ceremonial table that's often it's used at, you know, everything from VFW posts to on Memorial Day at functions to help people remember. And there's a poem that goes with it, and it's you know, highly symbolic to try and invite us to recall what does it mean again to not come home, and how do service members, especially veterans of the Vietnam War, how do they honor that? And then finally, and this is, you know, as an anthropologist, I'm interested in what this means to families and how families generate their own forms of ritual, whether it's here in D.C. at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial at the Wall, a ritual return and leaving of objects that families do on a regular basis, or are they rituals of remembrance in Red Cliff at the VFW post? In April of 2017, the Sewellier family, this is Dwayne Sewellier, who's killed in action, body not recovered, that family invited the community to come to the post and on one day to remember his life. He comes from a Native American family. It's the Red Cliff Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa, and sort of intermingled in military ritual and, you know, the local family remembering their lost brother and uncle and so on. There were also some tribal traditions. And so I just being present for that and seeing how that process, even though he had not come home, they were sort of forging and melding their own traditions in order to help us remember his life, who he was to them.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're so welcome. Thank you very much.
That's Sarah Wagner, Associate Professor of Anthropology at George Washington University. She joined us to talk about her new book. It's called What Remains, Bringing America's Missing Home from the Vietnam War. Let me be the first to wish you a happy Valentine's Day this week. What's that? You already got a Valentine's text message on a chilly November evening? If you did, you're not alone. A couple nights back, thousands of people around the country got text messages that appeared to have been sent months ago. Many of them had a Valentine's Day theme. What was going on? According to media reports, it wasn't just happening to people with one kind of phone or one cell provider. The big-name wireless companies were just as confused as the people getting Valentine's Day love notes in mid-autumn. The nine-month message delay was traced back to a networking company that I had never heard of before. Apparently, one of their message servers failed on February 14th of this year. And for some reason, they just got it unclogged this week. According to the company Cineverse, 168,149 messages were delayed in the mishap. It might not sound so bad getting a long-lost love note on a non-holiday. Just one problem. Local reporters around the country have talked to some of the people who received those Valentine's notes. And in a few cases, the passage of 9 months turned boyfriends and girlfriends into ex-boyfriends and ex-girlfriends. As the youth say, awkward. If you got one of these mystery texts, we'd love to hear from you. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll watch for that in about 9 months or so. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.